From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, Steve Inskeep talks about his latest book, Imperfect Union, and the historical impact of Jesse and John Fremont. Then a philosopher muses on why the Super Bowl is a stronger cultural touchstone than the World Series.
You win or you lose the Super Bowl on one day, and on any given day, any team can beat any other team. Over a course of a 7-game series in a World Series, that's very different. And so the concentration of the Super Bowl is, I think, a really important, attractive element to it.
Then Healthy Body Basics keeps things simple with 1-minute exercises to help you stay moving in the new year.
You think back to grade school, like, oh, they made us march in place. Well, that actually is an excellent warm-up to do more exercise, but it's an exercise in itself that you can do just about anywhere.
And we'll discuss the disparity in how men and women experience heart attacks. Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Bonnie North. In 1850, a magazine declared John Fremont as one of the three most important world historical figures since Jesus Christ. Wait, who? Well, most of us don't recall the name Fremont from our history lessons, even though you can find a Fremont village, river, hotel, or even school throughout the country. But John Fremont was very much a part of westward expansion, the mapping of America, the Civil War, and even the origins of the Republican Party. John's wife, Jessie, was an equally important historical figure, the daughter of a U.S. senator who was deeply involved in the West. Jessie Fremont used her connections to make her husband's career as a wilderness explorer, a writer, army officer, and a California conqueror possible. Steve Inskeep dives into the lives of the Fremonts in his latest book, Imperfect Union. He joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to share why this power couple of the 19th century should capture everyone's attention.
Steve Inskeep, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Glad to be on the program.
So despite some sort of street building or establishment named after the Fremonts all around the country, most of us didn't learn about them in our history courses. So what first drew you to their story?
I'm not sure that we learn a lot in any history courses. I wish Americans knew more history. I wish I knew more history, frankly. But I did read history as a kid. And I read things that, I don't know, stereotypically you'd think a little boy would read about. I mean, I read about the Old West and gunfighters and also the Civil War, and I got interested in railroads. And it's really interesting when you read about the Old West, the Fremonts appear in some of those books as these very famous and interesting characters. He's a Western explorer. You read about the Civil War and you discover them again because he was a Civil War general. And she, Jesse Fremont, had an argument with Abraham Lincoln. You read about railroads and there they are again. They're all through 19th century history. So later, as a grown-up, when I began looking at westward expansion, they seemed to me to be ideal characters to focus on. It was an opportunity to tell the story of a developing nation through the eyes of these two very interesting people.
And considering especially John Fremont's role in mapping the West, I'm quite surprised that I don't recall any lessons about them in all of our lessons about manifest destiny. You know, it's our duty, it's our obligation to go and expand West.
Yeah, I think that this is a period that we as Americans are not quite sure what we think about, because a lot of people were shoved out of the way in a very racist way for white settlement. And it was not all white settlement, by the way. There were very diverse, very different kinds of people moving west, but it was seen as this new race of people, the Americans, going west and shoving aside Indians and shoving aside Mexicans to make room for the American version of civilization. We're not sure what we think about that, and so it's a little hard to teach it precisely, even though we can be proud or can feel proud of the result, this grand and global nation that would not be what it is but for reaching from sea to sea.
Exactly, and I will come back to that point, but with Jesse's early history of mapping the West, you know, just reading some of the trials and tribulations, but also just the tools that he had to use and how smart he was with how, I can't even fathom, you know, how they did that. So I'm curious, did you get to familiarize yourself with the tools Fremont would have used during his mapping expeditions?
Yeah, I tried to. They're really basic. At one point, even I bought a sextant. You know, I ordered a sextant and tried to figure out how to use it to, you know, measure the angle of the sun. It's a remarkable challenge. and one that I really didn't understand, and I'm not sure that I have much more than an amateur understanding of it now. But think about this. The problem that you face, it's the 19th century, and people all around the world were facing this problem. And the question was, how do you measure the surface of the Earth, the distance between places, and the way that they look? How do you do that when you can only ever see a tiny bit of the Earth at any one time? Even on the highest place you can climb to, you only see a tiny bit of it, and it's very hard to measure. You're not going to get a satellite view in 1842. And so what they would do was navigate the same way that sailors were doing at sea, using the sun and the stars. And you would have to take rigorous and precise measurements and figure out the exact angle of the sun at an exact time of day on a particular day of the year, and using that and comparing it with other measurements that had been taken at other times and also meticulously recorded, you could figure out maybe where you were on the surface of the Earth. Or you could be guided by the North Star if you took the readings at night, or various other constellations. You could do these things, and you could also use a barometer to measure altitude, because of course the air gets thinner as you go higher. And of course you have to make allowances for the weather and everything else, but you can get an idea of how high you are, provided you're able to compare your current measurement with measurements taken meticulously at sea level or someplace else. It was this constant process. And one of the things that I love about learning about John C. Fremont doing this is that he was an amateur. He was a guy who had gotten interested in celestial navigation by looking at the pictures in a book that was in Dutch, which he could not read. That was his formal education in celestial navigation. And then he became a kind of apprentice to a French immigrant named Nicolet, who mapped parts of the upper Midwest and the source of the Mississippi River and other areas. And Fremont got to go along on a couple of his expeditions. And so he learned his task, he learned his science that way. Now, there have been critics about how precise he was or how precise he wasn't, and he would even get into controversy with other cartographers, but he did one commendable thing, and that is that in making maps of the surface of the Earth, he would only put on the map things he had seen himself. He would not rely on the reports or rumors of other people, and therefore his maps would have blank spaces if he hadn't been there. They wouldn't have rivers that didn't really exist or mountains that weren't quite there or things that were on other maps at the time.
And of course, one way Americans got to learn about all of his mapping adventures was through the written accounts that his wife, Jessie Fremont, was able to help ghostwrite, publish, facilitate. And I find her to be quite an astounding person.
Yeah.
Even with the fact that she tried to follow her father and work for him simply by cutting her hair, that it would be easier to follow him as if she presented like a male. And I'm wondering what you think of their relationship in particular, because it starts, they're engaged for a short time, married for a short time, and then he's off on expeditions. And this is a ton of time. So what do you think of their relationship being truly special, especially considering a lot of their marriage was spent apart?
Yeah, it was a strange relationship, although I don't think it was totally unprecedented for the time for people to be away from home, for men to be away from home, away from their wives and families for months or years at a time, because transit was so slow and communication was so bad and certain jobs demanded this. But he was an extraordinary case even for then, because he would be gone for months or even years at a time and leaving her behind. But there was something that she, Jessie, got out of this young U.S. Army lieutenant. She was a girl. She was in a very gendered society with very strict gender roles. She did get an opportunity to be educated more as a boy was, and in fact had a boy-sounding name because Senator Thomas Hart Benton had wanted a son and wanted to name the son after his father, Jessie. Got a daughter, so he changed the name slightly, the spelling slightly, and called her Jessie. And took her around with him as he went to work at the U.S. Senate, or took her with him when he went to visit various presidents, beginning with Andrew Jackson. And she became interested in politics and wanted to do things that were supposed to be reserved for men. The expansion of the West, political life itself, ambition, running for office. She wanted to do these things. She was restricted, of course, from doing them, but was able to operate to some degree through her equally ambitious and very talented husband, who she promoted in endless ways. And when he was away for those many months or years, she would serve as his publicist and political representative in Washington, often going to visit and chat with much older senators and even presidents whom she had known since she was a girl.
Now, with your job as a radio host, of course, people will most recognize, and your career as an author, I'm curious, how does your job in radio influence your writing style for your books, or vice versa? Because with history, it's so important to set the stage in an engaging way.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I think that one of the most flattering things that I've heard about this book is people will say, when I read it, I hear your voice. I hope that that would be true because I'm writing the way that I talk and I'm doing that for the radio and trying also to do that in print, even though perhaps the sentences are a little longer and the story is certainly longer. But there's something that is in common between the two kinds of writing, and that is that you try both in radio and on the printed page, you try, or you, I try, let's say that, to write visually, to put pictures in people's heads, to make sure that you can see the landscape passing by, so that when John C. Fremont climbs a mountain and nearly dies on the way up the mountain and finally plants an American flag on the top of the mountain, I hope that you can see that image of him looking out over other peaks in the Rocky Mountains and deciding he must have climbed the highest point in North America, which he hadn't, but it made a great story and he was a great publicist, so he went with that. I hope that you get a chance to see that. And I hope that's also true on the radio, where we're telling stories. And we, for a long time, had that phrase, NPR takes you there, that we would have sounds that would take you to a place on the other side of the world you would never otherwise visit. And often it's actually the words that take you there. It's the stories that take you there. So I'm always trying to write in a visual way for either medium. And sometimes I'm doing both on the same day. I'm working the show in the morning and writing a book in the afternoon.
Well, you certainly take us there in a great way, and it was fantastic to explore the lives of these amazing people.
Yeah, it's been fun. Thank you very much.
Steve Inskeep is a journalist, a host of NPR's Morning Edition, and the author of Imperfect Union, How Jesse and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski from a studio in Washington, D.C. Coming up next, a philosopher examines the place the Super Bowl has in pop culture, especially for people who don't even like football. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. There are many reasons we watch the Super Bowl. Maybe it's the halftime guests and that big production that surrounds them. Maybe it's the ads. Companies really step up their game, knowing millions of people will be watching and talking about them. Or it could be all of those things, plus a love of the actual game itself. Well, whatever your reasons for watching or not, you are participating in a cultural phenomenon. James South is a professor of philosophy at Marquette University and a pop culture expert. We asked him to talk with us about the Super Bowl and to explain why it's such a cultural touchstone in American society.
There are certainly historical precedents for the Super Bowl throughout human history, from the Olympics in ancient Greece to today, the Super Bowl or any other national championship kind of game. There seems to be something about the nature of competition and excellence in competition that appeals to human beings.
Okay, so I was thinking, as I was making notes to myself, I was thinking, is this our Roman spectacle?
I think it's certainly one of our Roman spectacles. I think it's our most Roman of spectacles.
Our own gladiators and entertainment.
When you think about the NBA championship or the World Series or Wimbledon or something like that, you don't have the same pre-build-up, you don't have the same halftime show, you don't have the same sort of cultural excitement about it, that even people who otherwise don't watch football will watch that game, sometimes just for the advertising.
That's one of my things. We'll get to that in a minute. But I'm wondering why football? Why do you think it is this particular sport that encourages this kind of adulation?
I think the violence has something to do with it, to be perfectly honest. I mean, I think it's a contact sport. Other than hockey, I can't think of more of a contact sport that's prevalent in the USA or North America. And so I think that the competition, at any point, a fight could break out, a disagreement.
Bloodlust.
Yes, there's just something. And there's also something about the admiration for the two teams that actually make it to this game, even if you don't have any local investment in them, you realize that they've undergone a very grueling season. They're all hurt, they're all injured, they're all bruised, and yet they're out there still playing their hearts out.
Yeah, and you know, I'm more of a baseball fan than I am a football fan, and I wonder, is it just the lack of violence? Because baseball doesn't really have that, and they have a grueling season, and the, you know, you get to the World Series, and may the best two of the teams win, kind of thing. But it seems like it's a much more genteel way of competing.
Well, I think in baseball, there's not one chance, right? This you win or you lose a Super Bowl on one day. And on any given day, any team can beat any other team. Over a course of a 7-game series and a World Series, that's very different. And so the concentration of the Super Bowl is, I think, a really important, attractive element to it.
What about the money? Because there's a lot of money both spent and made. Is that part of the appeal, too, that this, like, huge, opulent, lavish spectacle?
I think it is. I think it's a way that we indulge ourselves into thinking that this means something really important to not just us, but to the teams that are playing, to the areas that are represented, to the culture at large. And again, I'm not myself a huge football fan, but I'm going to watch the game because I'm going to want to talk about it around the water cooler the next day.
And I think that's an important point you make there, too, is that is it one of those things that gathers all of us together in a way that other things don't?
Well, I think having so many different teams in the NFL is something that brings communities into the cycle that leads into the series. So even though I know there are lots of Green Bay Packers fans who are very disappointed that they're not going to be playing on Sunday, at the same time, they've been watching the Packers play all these other teams for 17 games or 16 games, and of course they're going to be interested in this. And there's a tendency for us to take sides regardless. And is there an underdog? Do we root for the underdog? Do we root for the team that we think is going to win? The amount of betting that goes on about this?
That is a whole different money piece.
A very different money piece, but a very crucial money piece because, like I said, on any given day, any team can beat another team. And upsets occur routinely in the Super Bowl. I remember as a kid when the New York Jets won the Super Bowl, and it was such a big upset, and it launched Joe Namath's career. And I was in the bookstore yesterday, and he's got an autobiography out, right? We haven't forgotten Joe Namath because of that upset.
Well, and I was thinking of all the bookies who either made or lost that day when
exactly.
they upset
exactly.
as well, and probably changed the course of a lot of different careers. You mentioned the ads, and of course, people who are not football fans at all will often tune in simply to watch the advertisements, which have become their own thing. And obviously that's a big part of this, too. When did that first start happening, when the ads became almost as important as the game itself?
I'm not a historian of this by any means, but in my recollection, and I'm old enough to remember the first retroactively called Super Bowl, I don't remember this being this big of a deal until the late 80s. And certainly that's when people started introducing new items, trying to sell their, you know, primary product, the top-of-the-line product. This year we've got Mike Bloomberg, who's got an advertisement on the Super Bowl. That must be costing him a fortune, but he can afford it, and he thinks he's got a reason to do it. And
he's certainly going to have an audience.
And he's going to have a built-in audience. That's right. And as you said, I know that the day after the Super Bowl, even if I've watched it, I will go on YouTube and I will watch the compilation of ads because people put a lot of money and creative time into those ads for Super Bowl games that they don't put into other ads.
Because, some of them are fabulous.
Because they want to be talked about.
Right.
Yes. And they
right.
want to be associated with that excitement and competitiveness of the Super Bowl.
And we mentioned the halftime show, and that is another big cultural. I mean, for somebody to be invited to be the main halftime performer is a huge career boost. If they aren't already superstars like Beyonce,
mm-hmm.
but that's still a boost for her.
That's correct.
Yeah.
No, or they wouldn't agree to do it.
Right.
And, of course, we know there have been both controversial and non-controversial Super Bowl halftime shows. And, again, that's something that just seems different from other professional sports.
Yeah, it does to me, too, is like we've got this whole culture around this one thing that is even separate from the rest of the football season.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
It is an extra long halftime because they've got to do this spectacle. And I mean, I remember going to baseball games when I was younger, and on the 4th of July, there'd be fireworks after the game. But that's not the same thing as a halftime show at the Super Bowl.
With fireworks and overflights and whatever else
all
is going on.
All of those things.
Yeah. The rigging alone for that, you know, probably would feed a small city just on the pay for those guys.
Exactly. Yeah. And, of course, the people who want to be seen at the Super Bowl, too. Just being affiliated with the Super Bowl sometimes makes people who attend the Super Bowl seem more interesting to other people. So, I mean, that's why presidents go to the Super Bowl. It's why they invite the Super Bowl winner to the White House afterwards. These are ways of gaining cultural cachet somehow among sports fans.
So what about the people who don't like football? How do they fit into this? Is it in opposition to all of this?
I would guess it would depend on why they don't like football. As I said, I myself am not someone who watches football obsessively. I will occasionally watch a game. But I think those who don't like football are still interested in being able to talk about this particular game. It's an event. It's a once-a-year event. It's something that you know when you walk into work, everybody's going to, that most of your coworkers are going to have watched, or there's going to have been a controversy, or there's going to have been a blown call by an official, and the next thing you know, you want to talk about it. Right? You want to be able to talk about it. So I know often I have read quickly in the morning articles about the Super Bowl or other football games so I can talk to people about them even if I haven't watched them.
And so philosophically, where does this fall in the pantheon of Western philosophy? Is this Bacchus and Dionysus?
I tend to think it's a combination. Right. So it's both Dionysian in terms of the excitement, the buildup, the release, the halftime show, the spectacle, the often accompanying violence that occurs with the winning team, you know, city after the game. Those are all very Dionysian things. On the other hand, you have to think about how much discipline these players and coaches have to be able to put all that out of their minds and play for 60 minutes without that getting in the way.
So it's both Apollonian and Dionysian.
It's both Apollonian and Dionysian.
Wow. I had never thought of football that way, particularly the Super Bowl. It was just...
Oh, but they have to, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they can't pay attention to the halftime show. They have to be back in the locker room trying to figure out how they're going to play better in the second half, what corrections they're going to make. So the ability of professional athletes, this is, you know, what makes them professional, or dedicated athletes in other kinds of championships, is the self-control that they have to exercise even in the midst of all the chaos and celebrityness and social interest that's going on. They have to stay focused.
Yeah, that's happening just around them.
Yeah. So yeah. I would say at that point, they're being as focused as any philosopher could be.
When does something like the Super Bowl, or maybe how is the better question, how does it move from a pop culture thing to just culture? How does it influence our greater culture beyond the day and event itself?
Well, I think one way it seeps into the culture at large is, and I mean, and this gets back to thinking about the Olympics or thinking about the gladiators or something of that sort, is just the fact that they use Roman numerals to identify them. It makes it seem more important than saying the 2020 World Series. It doesn't sound nearly as exciting as Super Bowl 54 or 55 with Roman numerals, right? And so if you add that to it, you're giving the culture a sense that this game has a meaning to it and a history to it, and it's connected with a history of competition that you don't ordinarily get with other sporting events.
And you really don't. The Olympics, somewhat.
Somewhat.
But that's only once every 4 years.
And that's
very, well,
and that's very national pride oriented. Or, you know, sometimes just an amazing athletic feat by somebody gets your attention, even if you're not rooting for that team.
Right. So who are you going to be rooting for? Or are you going to be rooting for anyone? Or do you not want to say?
No, I will probably be rooting for the Kansas City Chiefs for all the wrong reasons, right? At least one wrong reason, which is that one of my favorite photos from a Super Bowl ever is a picture of Lynn Dawson, the quarterback of the Kansas City Chiefs in the Super Bowl. And he's sitting there, and it's on this very sparse sideline, not with any of the high-tech gear that we see today. He's got this wrap around him, and he's smoking a cigarette. And I just go, that's hardcore. And so there's something about the Kansas City Chiefs because of that picture. And that's what's so interesting about affiliations when, I mean, if you live in San Francisco, you're going to root for the 49ers. If you live in Kansas City or the Midwest, maybe you're going to root for the Chiefs, you're going to root for the underdog, whatever reasons that you might have for rooting for a team. But there's always that one thing that really hooks you individually and uniquely to a team that makes you root for them, I think.
So that photo was yours?
That photo is mine, and so I'll be rooting for the Chiefs. I know nothing about, really, the Kansas City Chiefs season, except they had a good one. I know they have a good team, but could I name
any of
the starting lineup? No, I couldn't, right?
Yeah.
And I feel, you know, sort of bad about that, but you didn't invite me on to analyze the Super Bowl.
So. No, not at all. Not at all. Well, James South, we'll see you at the water cooler the day after.
I look forward to it.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
James South is a professor of philosophy at Marquette University. He's an expert in pop culture. He will be watching the Super Bowl this Sunday. Coming up after a break, Healthy Body Basics keeps it short with one-minute exercises to help you keep fit. Lake Effect returns with that in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. It is just about the end of the first month of the new year, so how are those resolutions coming? Too often, we set goals for ourselves that are a little unrealistic. But if your goal is just to move more and move better, Healthy Body Basics can help. Often it's hard to find the time to incorporate vigorous exercise into our daily lives. But this is a case of even a little is better than none at all. Healthy Body Basics contributor Cynthia Akey says you don't need an hour or even 20 minutes to exercise to feel better. You just need one. Akey joins Audrey Nowakowski in the studio to go through some one-minute exercises you can incorporate into your day. And she starts by breaking down some misconceptions about time and exercise.
I think a lot of people just feel that, you know, I need to get in that minimum 20 minutes, 45 minutes on a treadmill before I really feel like I've done something and it's good for my body. But all of the health guidelines, government health guidelines, are actually saying, like, anytime you can move, move more. So, and that impacts all of our joints, all of our muscles, and thinking about that especially is like, how can we move as much as we can, even if it's a short period of time. So I'm always a big fan of whenever you've got a few moments that you're on your way to do something or you're waiting somewhere, how can you sneak in some exercise into your everyday?
Right. And what is incorporating these short exercises throughout the day do for our bodies and minds?
Well, definitely it's going to might change your mood, might get a little uplift because you're going to get a little rush of endorphins coming into your brain and to your body, sending obviously some circulation. So you might have felt more tired and now we're going to actually get some circulation moving. So we're going to feel a little bit more energized and also just prove your breathing. Definitely you're a little bit more aware, especially if you're doing some more stretching in one way or another, just taking that time to just take care of yourself.
Take care and notice. Yeah.
Yep.
Now, with cardio, most people might think, I don't need a minute of cardio. Why would I do that? You know, again, it's like either I need to be on the treadmill for at least 20 minutes or that kind of misconception. But if we're limited on space and time, what are some other ways we can?
Well, you know, it sounds so silly. Like you think back to grade school, like, oh, they made us march in place. Well, that actually is it's an excellent warm up to do more exercise. But it's an exercise in itself that you can do just about anywhere. And especially like when it's cold, it's a good thing to do. Like if you're standing at a bus stop or somewhere, it's a good thing to just try to keep circulation going. So and I do teach some classes where where the circuit is actually a minute, and I give a lot of different patterns that are these little cardio minutes of just some simple movement patterns, just like marching, that everyone is like, wow, I didn't think it was going to be that hard to maintain for a minute. But, you know, you're trying to heat up a cup of tea in the microwave and do some marching while you're waiting for that to heat up.
Yeah, or, well, I have a hard time with, like, arm and leg clearance for me, but jumping jacks is
exactly
another.
It is. Jumping
as a 6 foot one person,
yes.
But
yeah, jumping jacks is really good. Squatting, pushing, pulling. Once we start getting into some of the regular movement patterns that our bodies need to do every day,
and using what you have. Here's a countertop. Exactly.
So trying to think about, you know, strength. You can be doing push-ups at a countertop. You can be doing squats or lunges just about anywhere, depending on what you have. Like even using, we've done some things where even just using some canned goods is an easy, like just trying to add that in when you're just going like, oh, I just have a few minutes. What can I do? So, but know that your body is there and you can use your body weight to do a lot of different exercises really quickly and really easily.
Right. And your body weight is an asset.
That absolutely
for
is.
For sure. People think of strength training in a gym, in a weight room, you know, with various barbells, that thing. But that doesn't mean you're building your body the way it wants to function the most. You know, like if you're concentrating on too much stuff, moving better with your own body weight versus having that resistance against a totally different amount of weight that in the real world you're not going to come across.
Right. And it might not even necessarily be the right pattern for something that you do commonly. So carrying groceries, carrying laundry, carrying kids, walking dogs. So there's different strength required, even with walking a dog, of keeping shoulder stability, core stability, and knowing that you can do a lot of that just at home. Everything from we have planks. There's a lot of different core workout. And you can do things that, again, using a wall, a countertop, a table.
Now, and mobility is probably the most straightforward to incorporate and is also good for your joints, you know, because as we're sitting here, I can turn my ankles underneath the counter here, you know.
Exactly. So with mobility, we're just trying to increase the range of motion in all of our joints as best as we can. So with an elbow joint, obviously, we're going to be doing that hinging, flexion and extension motion. But wrists and ankles, taking care of hands, things, you know, if we're typing a lot, not realizing that, you know, your hands might get a little stiff. So knowing that you can open and close fingers, making fists and opening and closing really easy, circling wrists, circling ankles, taking care of your neck, just doing a few simple neck circles, as long as you're doing it slow and mindfully and aware of any tension points, so where things might be a little bit more stuck or uncomfortable.
On that note of just recognizing and taking care of yourself, one place a lot of people fall short on, myself included, is stretching, you know, taking care of yourself after the workout. So
it is one of the most common things for anyone who's doing any type of sporting activity that they stretching. I don't have time for that.
I don't need a cool down today. I'm just going to lie in bed. But, you know, there's a couple types of stretching. So what is the difference between a dynamic stretch and a static stretch?
So dynamic stretch, a lot of people tend to see that more with people that are running track. That's a really obvious way to see that. Or someone who's going to be playing basketball, something that they might be making arm circles. They might be kicking their legs up high. So again, it's trying to lengthen with some movement, purposeful movement, obviously. So we're not just swinging stuff around, but just trying to take a little bit more time to open up the chest. If we're doing arm crosses or arm swings, legs, we're trying to get into hips and hamstrings, trying to loosen that up.
Right.
So, and then static stretching is we're just trying to stretch the actual muscle, putting it into a lengthened position and giving it time, because that's what it usually takes. It takes some time, which is what we always feel like we don't have. But knowing that a nice way, a lot of people go, well, how long am I supposed to hold that stretch? I don't understand. Like, I don't have a watch near me, or I don't set a timer. Like, what can I do? So I like to tell people to go with that 3 to 5 breath as a starting point to hold a stretch so that your body can actually get into it. So when we know that our inhalation and exhalation takes approximately 5 to 6 seconds, when you get at least to 15 seconds for 3, and if you can get up to 5 or 6, you're getting closer to 30, 35. So knowing that we want to get to that, at least that 30-second amount of time. So you can understand, like, I can take 5 breaths, I can be in this stretch, and then I can move on to maybe something else that right. needs a stretch, and it's not so bad. So.
Well, and making sure to stretch to the point of, you know, some discomfort where obviously you know you are not lengthening on the regular basis, but
right.
not so far where that's going to...
Yes.
put you to tweak that muscle over,
right.
or overextend.
Well, and ideally, the reason that we are stretching is to try to keep those muscles nice and pliable so that they know the full range of the stretch that is possible, so keeping them long and comfortable.
Another thing along that note that builds with time is also just balance. Recognizing we all have a weak side, we all have a strong side.
And we really do. And there's a lot of different ways that you can play with balance. So, again, I bring that into a lot of my classes that we actually start it. We start the class with standing on a single leg and learning how to not lock the knee, really stabilize the foot, engage the core, lift and lengthen so that you've got a lot of strength in your posture as well. And then you start playing with it. So, like, where is the instability? Is it in your foot? Is it in your ankle? Is it in your leg? Is it in your core? Like, starting to notice where those little points are that can be the places, the weak points. So we want to find those weak links so we can start knowing that we should be strengthening them or stretching them, depending on what we need. But balance is definitely something that is really easy. And, again, thinking about the moments of time when you're drying your hair or brushing your teeth, things that can make a difference. So just taking an assessment of noticing, like, which side of the body needs a little bit more work, then to step it up a notch, I start having people work on closing their eyes.
It's amazing how hard it is to balance. The first time I did that was in physical therapy. I was getting over an ankle injury.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, stand on your weakened foot and now close your eyes.
And
I was shaking like a leaf. Like,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So obviously we wouldn't do that when we're drying our hair or brushing
exactly.
our teeth. But if you're going to do that test, start noticing, like, how can you engage all those points to make it stronger to get a sense of that balance? And then close the eyes and see how many breaths you can take or how many seconds that might take to where you're going to fall out of it. Obviously, have arms out, ready to get
clear space,
ready to catch yourself, or even practicing this near a wall so you've got something to touch too. And then another level of balance practice is actually working on inner ears. So same thing, lifting a foot and then tipping your head over to one side, and you'll be amazed the difference just by changing our proprioception within the body, and the fluid changing in our ears and our head will also make our balance a little tricky and easy for us to fall. And that's why we know that we need to practice every day.
Yeah. And we have all these exercises up online for quick 1 minute differences for people to make in a day. So
absolutely. It's great to give some people some inspiration of what you can do in a minute.
Lake Effect contributor Cynthia Akey is a certified yoga instructor, a personal trainer, and a wellness coach. She and contributor Lucian Jung produce Healthy Body Basics for Lake Effect. You can find other Healthy Body Basics segments at WUWM.com. And remember to always consult your doctor before starting a new physical routine. Well, from exercise to help keep you healthy to the warning signs of heart disease in women. Lake Effect continues with that in just a moment on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. It's a common scene in sitcoms and films. Something chaotic happens. An older character looks overwhelmed, and they begin to grab at their chest. We all recognize it as the classic signs of a heart attack. But for many women, these scenes can be misleading. Although heart disease is the most common cause of death for women in the United States, cultural representations of heart attacks rarely present many of the typical symptoms for women. Dr. Nicole Lohr is the medical director of cardiovascular clinical trials at Froedtert, and she recently joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers to explain how women's heart attack symptoms can differ from what's typical for men.
A woman can very much present in the classical fashion that I think all of us see on TV, or we've heard others, you know, loved ones or friends have experiences. I have this squeezing chest pressure that really comes across my chest. It radiates to my arm or maybe my neck or my back, and it's really kind of a sudden onset. I get a little short of breath and winded, and it just kind of builds in intensity. To me, that is really the elephant sitting on the chest version that we all hear. We've made numerous public announcements like call 911, don't drive yourself, call 911 and get to a hospital immediately. So by and large, you know, there will be a certain proportion of women that experience that. A lot of women actually have a lot, I would call them nondescript symptoms. Exertional breathlessness that just kind of, I'm fatigued, I'm tired, well, I feel so kind of sad and down. I have nausea, I feel like I'm going to throw up. You know, there might be a little bit of tingling or maybe some neck or jaw pain, but nothing that is really as quite dramatic as what we would appreciate. Anytime you start to have symptoms that kind of come on, abrupt onset, I would say, you should always kind of pay attention to those. What you're looking for is something that really doesn't go away. Some women don't even experience any symptoms.
Well, and that was something that came up in my research, and they called it a kind of silent heart attack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we see this in women. We see them, sometimes patients with diabetes, where basically you have a heart attack and maybe you just didn't really feel well for a day. And it was, like I said, really vague and nondescript. You kind of got better and you moved on with your life. And then you show up to a doctor, you have a test done, and somebody said, did you have a heart attack? So,
well, and that gets to a question that I had looking that up and looking up the symptoms of women in general, which aren't always identified as being connected to heart disease and can go unnoticed. It feels intuitive to say, well, if it went unnoticed, how detrimental could that heart attack have really been? But are the signs and the severity of the signs relative to the severity of the damage caused by a heart attack?
I think that's variable. So I would not make that correlation. I would say that, you know, obviously very severe heart attacks, the presenting symptom can be death, right? So we never had any prodrome whatsoever. But we shouldn't minimize, say, oh, well, you know, this didn't hurt bad enough for me to seek treatment. I always look for symptoms that kind of persist, that seem kind of a little bit out of the ordinary. I've had a woman that I treated who said, you know, I became incredibly anxious. And that is sometimes difficult. How do you come to an emergency department and say, well, I'm feeling anxious and something isn't right? As a doctor, that's like, okay, well, how do I put that together into something that's meaningful, especially a heart attack?
It seems like because the symptoms of heart disease, or specifically heart attacks, are less known by women, by the time they do seek treatment, they've often sustained a lot of damage. They mm-hmm. they come in with worse problems than they would have if they noticed it initially.
Yeah, so I think there's bias in two areas. There's bias by the patient herself. This really isn't happening to me. And I just had this experience with a family member where, well, no, I don't really want to hassle myself by seeking treatment. And then, sadly, I read one statistic that has always stayed with me as a physician, is that 53% of women in one survey, if they thought they were having a heart attack, wouldn't even dial 911. There is a reluctance to seek treatment for whatever reason. I don't want to be thought of as being foolish, some sense of denial, this isn't happening to me, I'm too busy. It's just a little heart attack, as the Go Red for Women through the American Heart Association has a great kind of funny skit. So the bias is on women not to seek care. And then there's a bias once you do seek care. So we have wonderful tests to measure, you know, troponins, which are proteins released by the heart during stress, like a heart attack or infection, EKGs that can give us a sense of what's going on. And even in women who have positive troponins, they're less likely to have a cardiac catheterization, which is the definitive test. So as health providers, we have to really recognize, how do we handle women who present with symptoms, you know, have presentations that suggest they're having a heart attack? Do we act on them as quickly as we should?
I have had my own issues getting doctors to really take my symptoms seriously. And the vast majority of women in my life have had similar experiences. If you're somebody who really truly believes that you are having issues with heart disease, but you're having an issue getting your doctor to do anything about it, how do you navigate that situation?
So I think that, especially as a woman who's a cardiologist, we have to empower our sisters, our friends, and other women in the community to be good advocates for themselves, which is sometimes hard to do. Patients will come to me and say, well, you know, I didn't really think it was going to be this, you know, and fill in the blank of the diagnosis. And I said, you know what? I am an expert in understanding the pathophysiology and how to treat your problem, but you're an expert in you. And you know yourself better than I do. So I can't necessarily know that if your shortness of breath that started 2 weeks ago was something, I'm going to say it probably is. But you might know, well, no, I've had this before and I've lived with it. That means that you advocate for yourself and you find a physician who's willing to engage in the critical conversations you need to have.
So, as we said, even when women present with a lot of things connected to heart disease, they aren't as likely as their male counterparts to get treatment. But when they do get treatment, what does that look like?
That's an excellent question. And some of it depends on really what caused the heart attack. So, especially for women, you can have heart attacks where you don't have a typical blockage of the blood vessels that really feed your heart. If you have a blockage in those blood vessels, we call them epicardial vessels, that's the stents, that's the bypass surgeries. Women are obviously offered those same types of therapies. Whether or not they're appropriate really, again, depends on the cause. Non-obstructive coronary disease can also present as a myocardial infarction. We call that MNOCA. That's the term. And if you look at patients who have MNOCA, the preponderance is that they're women. The mechanism for that is actually quite a bit. It could be maybe the blood vessel spasmed. And so when you go in and do a heart catheterization, you don't see a blockage like we've been trained to look for. You know, the heart isn't just made up of big blood vessels that are sitting on the outside, but rather small blood vessels that regulate flow. That microvascular dysfunction can also cause ischemia and a heart attack. That's treated in a very different way, you know, focusing on cardiovascular risk factors. Is my blood pressure under control? Are my cholesterol in line with what the guidelines say? Am I exercising? Am I avoiding smoking?
What are some of the things that are unique to women that are risk factors?
So if you were to come to see me and you're a woman, I start off by asking you what your pregnancy history is. Because we know pregnancy-related diseases, whether it be gestational diabetes, preeclampsia, it turns out that pregnancy is a wonderful stress test for us to kind of get a sense of really how your blood vessels react. And if you do end up with some of these diseases, you have almost a twofold increase of having a risk of a heart attack in the future. And that's a lifelong risk. It really doesn't go away. Interestingly enough, even having preterm birth, prematurity is a risk factor for the mother as well as the child. The science behind that is still evolving, but nevertheless, it's pretty interesting and obviously specific for women. There's also some diseases that women can acquire that actually are unique to them. So radiation related to breast cancer is one where we know that the dose of radiation can increase your cardiovascular risk, especially because it's centered on the chest. Thankfully, as we've made advancements in oncology, we're trying to reduce that risk. And some rheumatological diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, I say like your body becomes this milieu of inflammation, and that inflammation is a huge predictor of increasing cardiovascular risk.
What do you think are the most important takeaways for women when they are thinking about their heart health, when they're thinking about possible care? What are the things you really want women to know?
The majority of cardiovascular risk is actually in their hands. So reducing their risk through exercise, making sure their blood pressure is within normal limits. How do you do that? You make good choices in what you eat. You reduce stress. Stress is a huge risk factor that can be modified, and the subsequent depression that women can sometimes experience. Good mental and spiritual health, as well as really the standards exercise and good diet.
All right. Well, Dr. Lohr, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Nicole Lohr is the Medical Director of Cardiovascular Clinical Trials at Froedtert, and she's an Associate Professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin. You can find more of our conversations with doctors from the Medical College at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It is 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.